This week in the markets, gold closed at the highest point in over 6 years. On news, the Fed will make a second rate cut next month. Well, welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzik. Pleasure to be with you this August 2nd, Season 14, Episode 707. Well, the Fed surprised many investors this week, not only cutting rates a quarter point, but announcing plans for another cut as soon as next month. Traders are now scratching their heads saying, what does Chairman Jerome Powell know that we don't? The news cratered many U.S. shares, but the XAU and gold moved higher. Peter Grandich of Peter Grandich & Company and Pete Speaks returns from retirement with his personal investment strategy. He says he's directed almost his entire family nest egg to the precious metals sector. And we both agree that silver represents an incredible bargain, near 90 to 1 on the gold to silver ratio still. We're looking for AG to play catch up with XAU and gold. Possibly the investment opportunity of a lifetime. 1 ounce of gold can buy about 90 ounces of silver. Just if you get back to norms, you know, that could be as much as a fourfold increase in the price of silver just relative to gold without any appreciation in the general markets themselves. Then Dr. Paul Craig Roberts of the Institute of Political Economy and author of several best-selling tomes rejoins the show. It's total debt outstanding that's keeping him up at night, especially the Fed's balance sheet, which is still $3 trillion, that's with a T. That's a million stacks of 1 million, or it could make a town of 1 million people millionaires overnight. And we ponder whether or not this might be looked back on, this time right here, as the beginning of the big runaway inflation. And remember to call into our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900. If you call in next week, we'll probably have it up. So be sure and call in. If you've been on the sidelines, on the fence, just waiting, call in. You'll need our mailbox number, 514049. That number again, 641-715-3900. And you can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report and a quick tribute to a remarkable individual who lived approximately 100 years ago, is the unsung hero of the computer age. I mean, when we think of computer technology, if you haven't seen my Nuggets webpage today, I did a little write-up here on Nikola Tesla, created the transistor. When we think of the transistor today, most people think of, they'll think of Dr. Shockley and Dr. Noyce, and of course, some of the folks on that original team of Fairchild Semiconductor is still around today in Silicon Valley. We were informed this week, Nikola Tesla in 1898, some of my electronics fans may remember, he built that remote control craft and then demonstrated it to a large crowd in New York City. Built into the electronics, a cursory transistor. We were using, instead of transistors, companies were still using vacuum tubes in place of transistors 50 years in some cases. So this is a remarkable thing because if you think of it, what's at the heart of a computer? Transistors. Our computer age is built on, albeit very small, transistors. There are many heroes along the way, many unsung heroes. I really believe we will look back on Nikola Tesla as an individual who was a type 1 Kardashev. I call him a 0.9 on the Kardashev level. And what I mean by that is I think he was 50 to 100 years ahead of his time. And I think we're less than 50 years away from reaching the next Kardashev level, which, as you may know, means virtually free energy. Everyone has access to energy beyond people's dreams. I'm convinced that we have found hundreds of images on Mars and on Earth. For my newer listeners, we've been doing this for months now, going through them and backing them out. You can find them at all the websites, the Nugget webpage too. They have left so many clues for us that we're working right now with plasma balls and Tesla coils. I have three, well, soon to be four here, and several flyback driver devices that I had to wire up partially myself. The entryway into the Kardashev Level 1, and there's some compelling evidence in the Middle East especially, Mesoamerica, and on the Red Planet. And now we're finding really advanced, we think, technologies on Mars, maybe beyond anything we found on Earth. If you want to get involved with me on this project, really nonprofit, it's just excitement about a new technology. If you have an engineering background, just an interest, a passion, reach out to me, gsradio@frontier.com or gsr@hughes.net. I'd like to have you on board and share some of our findings with you. Got over, I think, about a 200 to 240-page paper in rough draft stage right now. Of course, a lot of illustrations. Reach out to me because we're on the cusp of some really big things here as a society, and I think this could really usher in a remarkable age. That's my hope. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector for the 10th week running as investors continued to pour funds into gold and silver on expectations of yet another rate cut next month. At Friday's closing bell, the yellow metal remained near lofty levels, the highest actually in 6 years, up 25 bucks, about a percent, around 1457. Silver, though, gave back a bit, ending near break-even around 1627, about a dime, building up momentum for what we think is a run well above 20. And palladium and platinum were both off a bit. Palladium was off about 127, 8% at 1404, people favoring gold. And platinum fell $15, 2%, ending at 853. The top story driving the markets this week, gold reached the highest point since spring of 2013 on the heels of the FOMC meeting, where Chairman Powell on Wednesday dropped rates a quarter point, and he offered some guidance that led people to expect accommodative Fed monetary policy. That shocked the market a bit, and the current Chicago Mercantile Exchange Fed Funds futures suggest a rate cut cycle will be announced as soon as next month's September 18th meeting, about a 97% probability. Fed Chairman Powell described the reduction as a mid-cycle adjustment, not the sort of a lengthy rate-cutting process, however, two rate cuts back-to-back months. That's a bit indicative, I think, of a rate cut cycle. Adding support for the metals, Thursday afternoon, the U.S. president discussed additional tariffs on our largest trading partner. In a tweet, he noted, trade talks are continuing, and during talks, the U.S. will start on September 1st, putting additional tariffs of 10% on a remaining $300 billion of goods and services. But, you know, we've heard this talk before, and little has really come from it. The markets just keep chugging along. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, our good friend Jim Cramer, Mad Money CNBC investor icon, noted, I think the broader market could go lower. And if you're patient, you'll be able to pick up most of these names. Jim Cramer, Mad Money CNBC investor, noted that he thought gold looked pretty solid. The gold to silver ratio also touched an incredible 95 recently. It's back at around 90, though. It jumped up a bit this week. Think it's an incredible opportunity for people who missed the last chance to get in. I think it is at least half price its fair market value right now. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, heavy cloud cover appeared over the New York Stock Exchange after many stocks registered the highest levels in decades last week. Investors were concerned, though, by the 1-2 combination punch of last week's sluggish GDP number and the Fed's hint of less than rosy outlook on the economy. Investors saw it as a chance to book some hefty profits and raise some cash for bargain hunting. By Friday's closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow was off 707 points, only 2.5% at 26,485. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 finished 29.32, off 93, 3%, while the NASDAQ was off 193, about 4%, down 326 points, still treading water above 8,000. The top headline moving the shares markets this week, downbeat U.S. economic data released Thursday indicated the manufacturing index dropped to its lowest level since mid-2016, while construction spending also declined 1.3%. Then jobless claims were also inching up just a bit higher, 8,000 to 215,000 at the end of last month. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, Jim Cramer noted, maybe raise a little cash in your high flyers if you don't have enough already and get ready to do some buying. And I think that's pretty much what we see right now. People recognize we had a breakout, the share prices were higher, but maybe they needed to reassess things with new hints from the Fed. I really don't see this as the end is nigh. Caution is advisable for the time being. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. We'll be right back. thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source. Just a pleasure to welcome back Peter Grandich from Peter Grandich and Company. He's had some fantastic calls recently that we're really looking forward to sharing with our listeners today. Welcome back, Peter Grandich.
Oh, good to be back with you, Chris.
Thank you. And, you know, we've had a lot of interesting market action lately. You were looking for the precious metals to put in a rally, and we've had quite a rally. Silver, of course, really shone brightly last week. Can you tell, you know, what led you to your call and what you see on a forward basis?
Last July 31st, I made a personal decision to liquidate all non-gold-related equities but one and build a very large gold-related portfolio through physical bullion and other types of vehicles, ETFs, a couple of individual stocks, what have you. And I maintained that and through the latter part of the fall built it up and stated and believed that it would outperform the general equity markets going forward from that point. I don't have any, I don't sell it. I don't have any relations with mining companies for 6 years. There's nothing in this for me other than my personal gains, and it was a decision I didn't suggest to every person to do, but it was really to point out two things. One, that I thought the general equities market was coming towards an end, which I believe it's been forming a major top. We can discuss that in a moment. But more importantly, that a new mega bull market would be born in gold, and it would have three legs. The first I spoke of, and everybody knew that. It had to get through certain resistant levels between 1350 and 1375, and I call that the first leg, and we've had that. The second leg is what we're going through now, building a base above that resistance, and then eventually moving towards 1500. And then once we go through 1500, if I'm correct, then we'll really see a great acceleration, because that should be during the same phase that the stock market has now clearly topped out to a lot of people, and money will flow into the metals seeking an alternative from the general public and, you know, the Johnny-come-latelys. And by then, one should have already been positioned in such things as physical bullion and things related to it. And at the same time, as I noted most recently, just a couple weeks ago, I used a terminology I have only used four or five times in the 35 years I've been around the financial arena, and that is I felt that the stock market's gotten to the point where there was a reasonable chance of a crash, or at least a very sharp decline, something more than a correction. And I've actually established an initial short position, but I've been waiting for what I hoped to have been was a mini melt up into this inevitable interest rate cut a week or so from now to really establish that short position. I don't know if I'm going to get that opportunity, but I really think this is the bottom of the ninth with no extra innings coming to the equity market. So all in all, I would say the answer to your question is that I think gold is just in the early stages of a second phase, and silver is now joining it. We could talk about that as well. And I still think there's time for people to participate in it. But once it gets going, particularly once gold gets above 1500, which is still possible this year, and more likely it may take us to the spring of next year. But once that does, then I really think it's going to accelerate, and before our eyes will be challenging to make a new all nominal, new high, time high.
Well, first hat tip for that great call. I mean, you know, we do have the FOMC meeting with the Fed Funds Futures decision, I guess, 31st of this month. If you look at the St. Louis Fed, we certainly see very solid probabilities of a quarter point rate cut. We're probably not going to get that half point cut yet on the benchmark overnight lending rate. There really was a melt up. The Dow touched, I want to say, 121 year high. I mean, certainly all time record weekly close in the Dow Jones Industrials and, of course, NASDAQ, S&P at records as well. What do you say, though, to folks who are convinced, you know, as long as the market's making new highs, the mutual fund money and a lot of the other pension funds and institutions will continue to pour in funds. And, you know, we've had many guests who are convinced the stock share buybacks is a huge component of this rally, and they don't see any end of that. And then we've got 18 rate cuts around the world recently from other central banks as well, which is kind of supportive liquidity. Do you think maybe we could see a gold rally, a precious metals rally, along with global equities?
Chris, tell you, first of all, if you look back last July 31st and as we speak today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up less than 2%. The S&P itself is up only 2%. Gold's up almost 17%. And yet so many things, if you listen to what's said by some of the people you spoke of, or what I like to call the talking heads from the financial networks, you would have think there's been a much greater performance. Now, of course, they'll talk about just since this January, because of the mini meltdown we had in December. But given all the things you said, given the buybacks, given the dramatic interest rate cuts, given the fact that budget deficits don't even count, I mean, they actually got around to finally doing what they should have done a long time ago, and that's suspend the debt ceiling, because we've had the debt ceiling 231 times, and it's been violated. I mean, the bottom line is this. We're in whatever it is, the end stages of something that began almost 40 years ago. When I entered the business in the early 1980s, gold was predicted to go through the moon. The Business Week had run an article, a front page story, calling equities are dead. Interest rates were 18-20%, and no one thought they would ever be single digit, let alone go down to, you know, basically zero. And now, about 180 degrees or 40 years later, we're on the other spectrum. Up until recently, you found even people that used to be bullish on gold for years not even talking about it, or they ran off to pot stocks, or they ran off to, you know, cryptocurrencies or what have you. And everybody's an equity expert. And there lies the problem also, Chris. And again, I'm not a gold bug. I don't have any. I'm only interested in my own personal greedy motives. You know, people talk and realize that almost three-quarters of the licensed financial advisors now in the United States have only been licensed since the year 2000 going forward. So basically, they've been only working since the new millennium. And in that time, if you look back, and you would be shocked, even people that are involved in gold don't realize it. If you look back and you went back to January 1st, 2000, the Dow's up about 146%. The S&P is up just about 106%. And gold is up 395%. And then you can argue, okay, throw in the dividends that people would have made on the S&P and what have you, and double those returns for the Dow and the S&P, and gold still outperformed it. Yet, people talk about gold as a relic, it's a horrible investment, this, that, and the other. But meanwhile, three-quarters of the people who didn't participate in it or didn't simply see that it would outperform over the next 19 years, the very thing that everybody says is the greatest thing since, you know, bread was created, and that's, you know, the stock market. So I'm not worried about all those things that you mentioned. It is true. It's helped support it. But eventually, gravity takes hold. And the things that people have to understand, no matter how much the game has changed, and it has, it's become a high-technology casino. You know, 60% of the money's in passive investments, 20%'s in quant, so it's not the 100% active trading we used to have where a lot of retail participated. But eventually, stocks return to what they really are, and that's part ownership of businesses. And eventually, you can buy back all the stock you want and so forth and so on, but if you don't start selling widgets, more widgets, if you don't start making more real profits, the value of your company is going to go down, and that's where the stock market's at now. When you compare its overall valuations, all historically, all that stuff, and you look at what's happened in the gold market, how little money has been spent for years looking for it, it's not going to turn on the dime. It's suddenly, to me, far less riskier, if you want to look at it that way, to own gold right now than it is a general equity.
Our listeners will certainly appreciate those thoughts. Okay, can we talk then about the gold to silver ratio? You know, you may have seen it recently. We touched 95, meaning that 1 ounce of gold would essentially buy about 95 silver ounces. Okay, so 1 ounce coin, gold coin, 95 silver coins. That didn't last after last week, but we're close to 90 range. Do you agree that silver represents a remarkable value, especially considering that gold to silver ratio is out of whack?
What my thought was, and what I have stated for months, and that was in the first leg, gold would lead, because it's an institutionally driven, not an industrial considered metal, why people are buying it. Once we got into the second leg that we are now, silver would start to try to catch up and sometimes lead, and that can still happen here, because now there's at least some serious interest from institutions and retail, and they tend, especially retail, to favor silver versus gold simply because people like quantity versus quality. Not to say that silver's second tier, but in a sense it is, because gold will always be favorable. It's more of a monetary, geopolitical sort of play, than silver always gets impacted somewhat by industrial use. But needless to say, the ratio got extreme. I think it got to a 27-year difference. I think that's one of the reasons why in recent days you saw gold down but silver up, because some of that unwinding of long gold, short silver spreads were being, you know, unwound. I think they're both prepared to participate close to equal, some leading over another in this second leg up. And I just think, like I said, I think gold and silver will outperform general equities by a wide margin over the next few years. Chris, you know I'm out of the game of forecasting. I'm out of the newsletter game. I speak for myself. My business, that what's left of it in the twilight of my career, is basically planning retirement and state. So I really don't have any other incentive other than to speak my mind here. I know a lot of people for a lot of years have been frustrated because they don't understand. When you look at a very long picture, gold and silver continues to be one of the best places to be at. But because so many of those people tend to own mining shares, and mining shares had greatly underperformed for quite a while, and that's why there was this negative feeling about gold. And one thing I didn't point out that I think is very, very critical, in fact, it was probably in the top two reasons why I became so aggressive personally on wanting to own gold, and that was we continue to see, even to this date, large purchases by central banks. Now, it's funny. The people in the financial world, what I call the don't worry, be happy crowd on Wall Street, spend 24/7 speaking about all this stuff that the central banks are doing and how bullish it is for stocks and so forth and so on. But they pay no mind to how much those central banks have been buying up gold. Now, why were they buying up gold? Well, my personal reason, particularly China and Russia's large purchases, is because they're preparing for an eventual ending of the U.S. dollar as a world reserve. In fact, a little-known news story a few months back gave me real great confidence is when Malaysia announced that it was leading an Asian group to form a new currency backed by gold where the Asian countries can trade and not use the dollar. And so I believe we're moving towards, and it still may be years away, but I think it's only going to be months or a couple of years at best, where we're going to learn that certain countries have decided to no longer use the dollar as a world reserve currency, and one of the things that will be used in that new whatever it is a gold backing. So I think that's extremely bullish, and we've seen that the charts almost go off the charts of how Russia and China has been buying. And with all that out, with no real retail interest up until most recently, the stage is set for really what I believe in a few years' time will be a challenge to new nominal all-time highs for at least gold.
That's, again, going to get a lot of people very excited on GoldSeek.com radio. Always a pleasure to speak with Peter Granditch, just a Wall Street legend, and you've got to pick up his book. We've got links to that. Can't believe he graciously gave it away. So he really does care about those of us out here who are investors and are really serious about these markets. Peter Granditch, thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable redeemable through One Gold, or physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premium. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Many Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share, with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Many Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Many Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Many Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange, and in the US, MENEF. Remember to sign up to Many's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Many Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source.
Well, with Fed policymakers expected to begin a new rate cut cycle in less than 2 hours, it's a real pleasure to welcome back to GoldSeek Radio the former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy in the Reagan Administration and editor and columnist for Wall Street Journal Business Week. Welcome back, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts.
Well, thank you.
You know, the Fed head Jerome Powell will cut rates, Fed funds futures showing about 80% probability. We'll see a quarter rate point cut to around 2%. And this is on the heels of last week's weaker than expected GDP figure. Just how far do you think they'll go, and what does that mean for investors?
If you look at total creditor claims against the outstanding debt, here we're talking about not just personal debts, student loans, auto loans, mortgage loans, but the claim, you know, the holdings of government bonds, say U.S. Treasuries. These claims are really larger than the economy can pay. And so what we could be headed into is a regime of negative interest rates. Because what negative interest rates do is they reduce the outstanding. And it won't really matter from the standpoint of it shrinking savings to a level that they might be able to pay. Now, I don't think they can make them negative enough to shrink the debt down. And it seems to me sooner or later there's going to have to be some form of debt forgiveness. Debt's going to have to be written down. So when you ask what does it mean that they're cutting the rates, once again, since they don't tell us the truth about inflation, we don't really know what the real rates are. because we don't really know what the real inflation rate is, because they changed the way they measured it in order to minimize inflation. So these kinds of questions are hard to answer, and the economics profession doesn't pay much attention. So what we do know, I think, is that lowering the interest rates is not going to make investment in plant and equipment any more attractive. We already know it's not attractive, because what have the firms done with their profits but to buy back their own shares? Not only that, many of the firms have gone into debt, borrowing money in order to decapitalize themselves by buying back the shares. So we know for years now, industry hasn't seen any reason to invest. Instead, the companies are decapitalizing themselves. They're buying back their shares because it's the best use of their profits, or so they think. So if you're sitting on a bunch of profits and you don't see anything to do with them except buy back your shares, how come they cut the interest rates a quarter of a point or half a point or a point? Are you going to see investment all of a sudden more profitable? That's not going to happen.
You know, Dr. Roberts, this is an interesting point you bring up with the share buybacks. Clearly with debt low and expected to drop now, rates expected to drop on the issuance of corporate debt especially. This presents a conundrum because our CEOs are essentially unpaid for the most part. They're counting on those stock options of their companies to be their big payoff, many of them, not all. And, of course, the share buybacks gives an artificial inflation that I think you've alluded to correctly on the price there. And so do you think that it might be wise as soon as possible for our elected officials and other policymakers to curtail their compensation should be tied to another metric other than their share price appreciation? Maybe the better way would be to keep buybacks to a minimum.
Some years ago, Congress got it in their head that CEOs should not be paid more than $1 million a year in salary, unless it was performance related. And so what that meant then was that the main reward package to the executives, and of course to directors, came from rising share price. So that's why they do the buybacks. They do the buybacks. That was an unintended consequence of Congress legislating $1 million salary as the limit that could be written off as a business expense. So if they were paid a salary of $2 million, the second million would not be written off as an expense. And so they said, okay, but if the company has really good performance, then, and bonuses are reflecting that, then they can have those bonuses as pay, and they can be deducted as a business cost. So that's how it all started. The buybacks were a creation of Congress passing the other law, trying to limit compensation. I think it's probably a bit late in the game for them to come in and change it, because the problem really is that the American corporations don't see investment opportunities for their profits. They don't see investment opportunities for their borrowings, except to buy back their own shares. So we were looking at that as a way to understand whether or not a lower interest rate was likely to stimulate any new investment. And I think it's difficult to think that the lower interest rate can stimulate investment when the corporations don't see any place to invest other than buying back their shares. In fact, the lower interest rate will make it a little bit cheaper for them to borrow money to buy back their shares. Well, what the lower interest rate does, the way they will achieve the lower interest rate is by being there to buy bonds. You know, the Fed will buy more bonds. That's how they get the interest rate down. And the money going into the financial system will continue to prop up the stock market, even though profitability of the companies is falling. But where is the money going to go? What these lower interest rates sort of signal is more rounds of QE, of quantitative easing. So that money will keep the bubble whole. It'll keep the bubble from popping. So what you could say, and of course I don't know that this is a fact and can't prove it, but you could say that what the Fed is doing, having got the whole system in a bubble, it's decided it's got to keep it going. And so it's going to feed more money. And the money will keep the stock market up, even as there's nowhere to invest. And so share prices will get further removed from the profitability of the company. The P/E ratios will get more absurd. And so I think that's, in other words, the problems are not being dealt with. It's hard to see what the lower interest rate can do other than to put more liquidity from the Fed into financial assets.
Now, it's well said. Clearly, the Fed balance sheet is still hovering in the $3 trillion area. Anything over, I think, $500 billion was unprecedented just a decade ago before the Great Recession. And so one would have thought they had, with such a robust economy, an opportunity to clear that balance sheet considerably more than they have. So it almost appears as though we're entering, you know, the unsavory prospect of runaway money printing or possibly even inflation, which I think you addressed earlier. When does the music stop? Do you have a metric that you're monitoring, or do you think they're going to keep the shell game going longer than most people expect?
Yes, and I think they're going to keep the shell game going, and they can keep it going, as far as I can tell, until there is abandonment of the dollar. If de-dollarization spreads, and, of course, the sanctions that Washington keeps putting on other economies helps de-dollarization spread so that the sanctions, in effect, are undermining the dollar as world reserve currency. As people abandon it in order not to be vulnerable to sanctions. And here we're talking about a large part of the world, Russia, China, India, Iran, Venezuela. As they abandon the dollar, then it's hard for the Fed and the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England and the European Central Bank to keep the dollar propped up by all of those countries also creating money. So de-dollarization results in a reduced demand for dollars, and yet the supply is massive, and so the dollar could fall in value. The Fed, you see, can print all the money it needs to buy stocks and bonds, but it can't print foreign currencies with which to buy the dollar. So I think until the dollar starts being moved aside as the main world reserve currency, the Fed can keep the financial assets high. They buy bonds, therefore drives up the price. If the stock market tries to adjust, all the Fed has to do is purchase S&P futures, and it stops the fall. You know, people are not paying attention. The central banks now intervene in all kinds of things. For example, the Japanese central bank actually owns somewhere between a fifth and a fourth of all Japanese equities. The central bank actually buys the shares. What I think happens in the United States is the Fed doesn't buy the shares, but if the market starts to come down in a way that they're worried about, they step in and buy S&P futures. And that stops the decline. So when you have this level of manipulation, you really can't know what to expect. You know, say, you know, all this started in the last year of the Reagan administration with what they call the Plunge Protection Team. The George Herbert Walker Bush people were afraid that the economy, that the stock market would collapse. You know, they had that scare in 87, and that this would block George Herbert Walker Bush from getting the Republican nomination and being elected. So they created this, what they call the Plunge Protection Team, which was to ensure that George Herbert Walker Bush was Reagan's successor. Well, I don't think anybody understood at the time the consequences of that. But the Fed now has a massive trading desk. As far as I can tell, it can essentially intervene in any market. Commodities, gold, currencies, whatever. None of this gets any explanation or coverage. The economists are quiet. The financial press is quiet. And so people really haven't much clue about what's really going on. And the explanations we're given, for example, for quantitative easing, which was, oh, it'll spur investment and everybody will do better. That's not the reason they did it. They did it to bail out the big banks. And the process of bailing out the big banks, all the money, as you pointed out, the Fed's balance sheet went from $800 billion to $4.5 trillion. I don't know where it is now, whether they succeeded in reducing it very much. I doubt it. But all that money went into financial assets. And so you've had this great stock market boom for a decade that's not based in any reality. It's based in liquidity that the Fed pumped into the markets. And we know it's not based in any reality, Chris, because there hasn't been any growth in real family median income for a long time. We know that a huge percentage of young people are so burdened by student loans and poor job opportunities that they cannot form households. They live at home with their parents. There are practically as many people, 24 to 34 years old, living at home with the parents as are living independently. And that's because the huge debts, the student loan debts, the poor jobs, the low pay, they can't afford to live independently. So how are they buying and causing retail sales to support profits of companies? And clearly they aren't, because the companies don't see any reason to invest in expanding their output. And that's why they buy back the shares. I think I read not long ago that something like 100% of the profits of companies are used to buy back the shares. So if there are no investment opportunities because there's nothing to drive consumer demand, aggregate demand, what's to drive it? Not growth in real wages. Not business investment, because business investment is buying up, is decapitalizing the companies by buying the shares. If they borrow money, it's not for new plant and equipment, it's to buy back shares. So when you look at this picture, you know, it doesn't really make any sense. And so we come back to this notion that we have a booming economy. Do we? Or is that a statistical creation? If you undermeasure inflation, then the nominal GDP that you deflate is not fully deflated. And so the growth that you think you're seeing is really just a growth in prices, not real output. So there's so much rigmarole and rigging and the way they measure inflation is different than it used to be. It's measured in a way to understate it. Well, if you understate inflation, you overstate GDP growth. So it could well be there hasn't been any booming economy. That it could well be, and some people say it's the case, that there's been no growth in real output for a decade.
Our good friend John Williams at ShadowStats.com, you may be familiar with his alternative economic think tank research. He's crunched the numbers for decades for corporate America. If you look very carefully at his GDP numbers, when they're adjusted for his corrected inflation figures based on the 1980s number, he finds exactly what you just said. We've had flat to negative real GDP output. Appreciate your thoughts today on just how our officials might try to rectify the situation. Well, I shouldn't say rectify. I mean, according to you and many of our top guests here, Dr. Kotlikoff of Boston University agrees with you. They'll always try to keep the Titanic from taking on too much water and capsizing too quickly. Will we wake up and find that the dollar has a different name or moniker attached to it? Bank accounts still reflect the same amount of dollars, but have 50% less purchasing power.
Well, this is would be the implication of the dollar losing its world reserve currency role. You see, if you're the world reserve currency, which is the reason that we wanted to take it away from the British so much after World War II, if you're the world reserve currency, you can pay your bills by printing money. Because every other country is willing to hold your currency because it's the world reserves and all transactions are settled in it. And so it guarantees a demand for your money. And so that removes constraints on your ability to create it. And this is particularly the case when the United States has such financial predominance that it can achieve the cooperation of other central banks from Tokyo to the European Central Bank in maintaining the exchange rate stability of the dollar. Now, it fluctuates a little bit, but they keep it pretty much so that the printing of American dollars it does not result in the dollar losing its exchange value vis-a-vis the euro or the British pound or the Japanese yen, because if we print, they print. When we had quantitative easing, they had quantitative easing. In fact, I think the European Central Bank is now into negative interest rates. So until the dollar loses this role, it appears to be the case the Fed can keep everything going just by providing the liquidity, because the liquidity goes into financial assets, into the stock market. So what it means is that the polarization will get worse in the United States. We already have a situation where relatively few people get all of the gain in income and all of the gain in wealth because they're the ones that hold the shares. And so if the Fed keeps this going, then that is kept going is too. So that's kept going also. So the polarization worsens, the inequality in the distribution of income and wealth worsens. There's less of a domestic consumer market. There's less basis for the high stock prices because there's no way for aggregate consumer demand to grow. And yet, if the money's going into financial assets, what's going to make the price go down? So this has been going on for a decade. I never thought this would happen. I didn't think that when this started a decade ago, I thought, oh, well, they're going to cause hyperinflation. But it didn't go into consumer prices. It went into financial asset prices. So, I mean, some of it went into consumer prices, yes, but not anything like what boosted share prices. So we've already been through the fact that where is a source of strong aggregate demand? It's not in business investment. They invest in buying the shares, not plant and equipment. The consumers don't have any real increase in real purchasing power. The young can't even form households. So where is the dynamic economy? It's just not there. So they create the impression by the way they measure things. And as long as stock prices are higher, the elite are happy. The financial press is happy. Wall Street's happy. There's no complaint. The ordinary people don't have a voice. They're not important. They're not significant. They don't really understand what's going on. And so if you look at it, you know, in this way, which I think there's a good reason to look at it this way, it can go on until the dollar tanks. And what tanks the dollar, once again, is people say, look, it's too dangerous to use it. If we use the American systems and currency, we get hit with sanctions. So we're going to form our own SWIFT clearing system. We're going to form some way to settle our international transactions in our own currencies. We're going to bypass the dollar. In the past, when countries have tried to do this, like Gaddafi in Libya, we simply invade and kill him. China and Russia are a little bit too big for that. It's what we want to do to Iran. Iran says, you know, if we're going to abandon use of the dollar, well, that is what is a threat to us. Not tariffs. The threat is countries abandoning the use of the dollar. The demand for dollar shrinks. People don't want the dollars. You can't pay your bills by printing them. And we have big bills. You know, we run big trade deficits, big budget deficits. And those are financed by the willingness of the rest of the world to hold U.S. Treasury bonds. Well, that's the link right there. And that's the only point of vulnerability as far as I can tell. And if you try to think how is all the quantitative easing going to get into consumer prices, well, how does it get into the hands of people? A long time ago, in the Fed eased, it meant the banks could lend more money. And so people could acquire more debt and spend it. And this would help drive the economy. But, you know, they're so indebted now. And nobody, they can't service any more debt, and nobody will lend to them anyhow. So when you look at it, you know, realistically, you can say the thing is a Ponzi scheme, but its only weakness is how long will people and the rest of the world continue to hold dollars? Well, what do we know? We know the Russians and the Chinese are selling off treasury bonds and buying gold. The Russians have just about got rid of their dollar holdings. We threaten everybody with sanctions, even our allies like Germany. If you buy Russian natural gas, we're going to sanction you. So the sanctions drive people away from the dollar. So this is foolishness. I mean, Washington is doing things that is destroying the basis of their power, the willingness to hold dollars. Well, how long will it take for them to destroy the dollar with their own foolish policies such as sanctions? I don't know. I can't say. It depends on how quick the rest of the world reacts. These are not things anybody can know, but I think I've given an explanation of what the real situation might be, and it's quite different from what you hear politically and read in the financial press and hear from economics departments. As far as I can tell, the American economics profession hasn't a clue.
You know, you're not parroting the don't worry, be happy crowd. And do you see any other storm clouds on the horizon?
Well, first of all, people have to have some means. So many things have been violated. For example, you know, you have many countries, I don't know if we've joined them or not, that now your bank deposits aren't really yours, they're the bank's. You remember what happened in Cyprus when the bank just announced that, well, you can't have your deposits?
They lost virtually everything. I think they got half if they moved quickly.
I mean, we always did in terms of the FDIC. They would you were insured up to a certain amount. But this is something, this is a new development that if the bank's in trouble, instead of being bailed out, it just seizes its depositors' deposits. There's a name for that. I forget what they call it. I think we've legislated that as well, not just European countries and so on. And the Canadians may have it. So the public anger at the bailout of the banks 10 years ago resulted in some kind of law that in the future there's not to be a bailout, there's to be a bail-in. They just survive by seizing the deposits. So, you know, what's your money? You don't even know that anymore. Suppose you acquire gold somewhere. What's to stop them from seizing your holdings? What's to stop them from passing a law like the Roosevelt did that you can't hold gold, turn it in at the price that we decide? You know, what? There's some evidence they're trying to get rid of cash so that you don't even have that option. They want to force you into paying with a card. And that way they can turn off your ability to buy whenever they want. So, you know, I just don't know that there are any answers. I don't know, you know, in the past, foreign governments collapse under American pressure. We forced the big French bank to pay billions of dollars in fines because they financed some business with Iran. Well, what the hell business is it of the United States to tell France, a French bank, who they can do business with? But we do. And they did business with Iran and violated our unilateral, arbitrary, illegal sanctions. And so we told them, okay, close down all your business in the U.S. or pay us $6 billion. Chris, just think about it. Germany asked us to give back the gold that they were storing here. We said no. Or we said, we'll give you a little bit now and maybe some more in the future. Venezuela asked the Bank of England to return the gold that they had on deposit there, and they said no. So when governments can't enforce contracts they have with other governments, other central banks, to return their own property, how can an individual expect that he's going to somehow find a safe haven? Or Washington, we stole billions of dollars in Venezuelan deposits in our banks. I mean, I think the Venezuelan government was crazy to have any deposits in our banks, but they trusted the banking system, international law, and their country too, and they're a member of the United Nations. But we don't like what you did. You nationalized your oil and are using it for your people instead of for the profits of ExxonMobil. So it's stealing all your bank deposits. So, this type of behavior, how are you going to have a safe haven? Just a little individual. Wherever you look, you see this type of thing. I mean, look, we arrested, don't you remember, it wasn't that long ago, we arrested a high official, or the daughter of a high official of a Japanese technology firm. She's in Canada. It's a puppet state. It takes its orders from Washington. It's not an independent country. We said, go arrest that woman and hold her. We're mad at this technology company because it's getting ahead of us in certain markets. Well, this is gangsterism. So when the United States government itself becomes the lead gangster, where is their safe haven?
Do you then expect this to implode? What would be the first shot across the bow that we should be watching for?
It's like I say, it's already started. There's already de-dollarization. There are already agreements made to not use the dollar to settle transactions. I mean, the Russians and the Chinese have started that. This Silk Road thing will draw more into that. Southeast Asia. It's just, it seems to take longer than you think. I have no idea why in the world Russia and China didn't put an alternative SWIFT system up years ago. We keep hearing about it, they're talking about it, they're developing it, but it doesn't take any time to do that. Maybe they just don't want to pay the cost. Maybe they just want to use what we've already paid for. And so they're willing to take cost and sanctions not to have to put the thing into effect. I don't know. I don't know why they haven't. But it leaves them subject to these harassments and sanctions and seizure of assets, now seizure of people. So it's already started. The question is, when does it reach the straw that breaks the camel's back? Is this just a gradual thing, adding a straw every week, take forever, or is it going to be a pell-mell thing? Is it going to reach a point where there's just a run for the exits? I don't know. I don't know. And then if you look at the disunity in the United States, this identity politics we have, which teaches hatred. The population split. Everybody's calling somebody else a name. There's no unity. If you have no unity of people, you can't hold the government accountable. They hate Trump so bad, they've created a make-believe world that he's in a conspiracy with Putin. they have to impeach him. And there's no evidence whatsoever, but they all believe it. So facts don't matter. If facts don't matter, the truth doesn't matter. They frame up journalists. Julian Assange is framed up on some sort of crazy charges that make no sense. And he didn't publish anything any different than the New York Times published or the Guardian. But they're trying to shut people up, to stop people from telling the truth, because the truth gets in the way of their agendas. So they want to control the explanations. And they've done a good job of controlling the explanation of the economy. Everybody thinks, oh, we've had a boom for 10 years. Why didn't I get to participate in it? Oh, it's just me, some failure on my part. But everybody else did. So, I mean, you know, it's, you can tell people the absolute total truth. They can't tell the difference between the truth and fiction. It's more amenable to hear the fiction.
You know, it may not be the best news. Big dose of Veritas is just what we all, you know, that's where we find the solutions that even you are struggling, I think, to, well, all of us are struggling to identify here.
But, of course, truth, there's no respect for truth. It's discounted. Now it's all emote, emotion.
You found a venue here that appreciates your truth, and we can't thank you enough, and look forward to further comments from you, Dr. Roberts, and direct everybody over to your must bookmark webpage. Thank you.
Okay, Chris, appreciate your interest. I look forward to the link.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by TradeWind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Many Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share, with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Many Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Many Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Menne Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange and in the U.S. MENEF. Remember to sign up to Menne's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Menne Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Each week, when you listen to and process vast amounts of information, and dare I say, disinformation about topics of critical importance on politics, the economy, and other issues of direct relevance to your understanding of world events, you must stay vigilant. Because significant contradictions that are no doubt meant to steer a particular narrative in one direction or another are emerging with what appears to be more frequency from otherwise trusted sources and experts on a wide range of topics that I believe are meant to persuade you to either accept or dismiss some critical component of a much larger, potentially problematic narrative, and discourage you from engaging in further research, questions, or investigation. As the information war and the battle for your mind reaches epidemic proportions, I'm beginning to notice with more frequency that in certain interviews on the economy, politics, or other subjects of interest, where I may even find myself potentially agreeing with much of what is being said, that buried somewhere deep within the narrative is that one piece of information that makes you suddenly stop and exclaim to yourself, "What did they just say?" Because that one point, that one idea is so contradictory to the rest of the conversation that you have been listening to, and potentially nodding your head in agreement with, that you either swallow hard and try to accept that one point, like a bad-tasting pill you coat with peanut butter in order to make it go down smoothly, or you stop dead in your tracks and begin to question everything you have just heard and wonder aloud, is this person misinformed? Or are they trying to use their credibility to get me to look elsewhere or think differently? Or worse, to stop thinking entirely about a certain line of inquiry without further research, questions, or investigation? There was one topic in particular that brazenly caught my attention the past few weeks, where this kind of psychological misdirection was likely being employed. The host of a popular YouTube channel asked a well-known gold expert, who was promoting a new book, about the missing $21 trillion of unauthorized federal spending identified last year by Dr. Mark Skidmore and a team of graduate students at the University of Michigan, and how this missing, unauthorized, and unaccounted for money could impact the global financial markets. Instead of answering this question head on, the guest fumbled and referred to the subject of the missing $21 trillion as an accounting error. A $21 trillion accounting error? I couldn't believe my ears. And no, I didn't swallow hard to try and make that foul-tasting pill go down smoothly. Instead, I began to question why an esteemed expert would make such a sloppy statement without addressing the data and metrics that support that research. And in an uncharacteristic and politically correct moment, the host, who is usually quite tenacious and has referenced this very subject many times himself, did not really push for clarification on the reasoning or proportionality of such a careless answer, and simply moved on to other topics. In the grand scheme of things, some may think the actual acknowledged federal debt of $22 trillion is no big deal, when, depending on whose forecasts you listen to about unfunded debt, ranging from between $100 trillion to $200 trillion, that an extra $21 trillion is no big deal and may simply be an accounting error. But I think not. If you need to refresh yourself with the data, search this title on the internet. MSU scholars find $21 trillion in unauthorized government spending. This will take you to the Michigan State University published discussion on this research. After reading it, ask yourself if you think it is likely that this is still just an accounting error. Based on your answer, the larger, more disturbing question comes into view. Why are you being discouraged from engaging in further research, questions, or investigation on potentially problematic narratives such as this? Keep thinking and stay smart. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.